And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I am back from vacation.
Are you tanned, rested, and ready?
I don't tan.
rich cocoa tan.
My pinkness and paleness are the totality of my range. Mm. This week, as you may know, it's Upfronts week for the networks, so the next TV season cycle is essentially starting now. So we thought it was a good time to look at the last TV season cycle. So we're going to check in on some of the winners and losers of this year and some of the shows we've talked about in the past and how things turned out for them. We're also going to do a little segment that I personally am thinking of as Sunrise Sunset. Television has a way of being not great at portrayals either of the very old or the very young, and we're going to sort of get a little bit into TV and movies and aging. And then, of course, as always, we will close the show with what is making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table in case you, like I, have forgotten who these guys are while I was on vacation. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I am the movies editor for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Wonderful. I am so happy to see all of you again. I am rested, and I very much enjoyed my visit and my pottery making and other little vacation-y type activities. And I was very glad to hear that you guys had a good show while I was gone. Thanks to Matt Thompson for being
fun.
Here.
Yeah,
it was excellent, and I enjoyed the Avengers also, so I would have been of no help to you at all.
We needed a dissenting voice. Yeah,
we really needed somebody
to be like, you know what, screw the Avengers.
I would not have been that person. And it's Upfronts week, which means I have returned to the cacophony of networks insisting that absolutely everything that they have is going to be completely 100% awesome.
Terrific.
And that all the shows you care about are not being canceled.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. None of them are being canceled at all. There actually have been, I would say, fewer upsetting cancellations recently than in the past. There was a huge internet meltdown
that happened. A lot of upset, but not a lot of upsetting.
Right. Yeah. That happened last week when...
The rumor went about.
Chatterverse, yes. I suppose, I would say, was insisting that various shows like Community and Parks and Rec and some other ones were going to be ushered off into the great beyond, and much of that turned out to be false. So there have actually been fewer great wails of anger, but as always, we do have a bunch of new shows, and we also have fates for a bunch of old shows. Now, when we sat down at the beginning of this past TV season, we all picked a show to follow. And I think it's time to own up to what occurred. And I'm just going to tell you right now what I thought was a really safe pick, which was A Gifted Man.
How'd that work out for you?
Right? No, it was terrible. It was terrible. And this is where I sort of say nobody knows anything is something that William Goldman has said about movies. It's also true about television. It's very true about me. It comes up also, I just want to say, in a new book called Top of the Rock, which is an oral history of this sort of NBC comedy boom written by Warren Littlefield, who for a period of time was the president of NBC. And that book also makes this point that nobody knows anything, which brings us back to me not knowing anything.
Right.
Because my pick was A Gifted Man, which to me, Friday nights, CBS, gushy medical drama, Patrick Wilson, you know, he's a doctor, he sees ghosts, and he wants to just help people, and I don't know. It seemed
every
like...
Every one of those shows has been done to death, so you just imagine putting them all together.
Absolutely. It seemed to me like inevitable. Perfect oatmeal for the Friday night audience.
Well, yeah, and how many of those, you know, sort of, oh my God, it's a cop procedural. Like,
right.
You know, I mean, you would just assume that if it were,
exactly.
You know, CSI New Jersey or whatever, that it's going to succeed on the basis of the fact.
I felt like there was no competition. I felt like the expectations for it probably weren't very high. Not only was it not successful, but when it was finally officially canceled, the actual star of it, Patrick Wilson, basically tweeted, phew. So this did not go well for me, I would say, at all. Glenn Weldon, what did you pick?
My pick was Terra Nova.
How long did that one last?
Recently canceled, and I chose it because of dinosaurs. And what I didn't take into account is the fact that there'd be no freaking dinosaurs on the damn show.
Yeah, it's true. It was space colony stuff.
Oh my God, be the thing you're supposed to be about. Show. See, yeah. Also Walking Dead.
Yeah.
I signed on for dinosaurs. What I got was we have to sneak into the enemy camp and steal their medical supplies. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm done watching Little House on the Prairie. This is not a show I'm watching.
You wanted more dinosaurs.
I didn't want, so the surly teen in the show?
Yes.
Found a gang of other surly teens.
They decided, you know what, we need more surly teens.
Back on the team.
Many of
gang.
Whom, that's right, many of whom were wearing knit hats and fingerless gloves in a tropical climate.
In a
because
tropical.
Sure,
makes
why not?
Perfect sense.
You do.
So that didn't work out great for
didn't.
You.
I kept getting angry and angry because it's like, where's the dinosaurs? And then I realized the episode where a dinosaur egg opens and a little puppet comes out and goes, meh, and a little girl goes, can we keep him? I realized this is a kid's show. I didn't realize it until now. This is a kid's show.
It's Jurassic Park.
There was absolutely no layers, no depth to the dialogue. Every piece of dialogue was merely expositing things that were already... you could kind of see where the dialogue was going in every particular scene.
So Glenn's got all these opinions because he stuck it out.
I did. I did.
Stuck it out.
I stuck mine out.
Well, I'm just going to say.
Wow, really?
Jason O'Mara as the head guy, Naomi Scott as the older daughter, you can stay. You've got some charisma. You're going to go.
Everybody else is dead.
Stephen Lang, who basically spent the entire show being Steve Jobs for some reason. Yeah. I didn't quite understand what was going on.
So
there was a lot of inessential mystery. What's in this mystery box? Nobody cares. Yeah. So it's gone, and good riddance.
How about you, Trey? What did you pick?
I picked Pan Am.
How'd that work out for you?
It worked out about 5 episodes worth, as I recall.
Yeah.
Right?
That many.
Was it? Who remembers?
It was a little longer than that.
Who remembers? I got as far as Paris.
Like the Playboy Club, it suffered an attack of complete nostalgia ambivalence on the part of the American audience.
The American public.
I mean, so was it good?
Yeah, I was going to say, I barely remember it.
It was very stylish.
It was stylish.
It was fun
to
look at. It suffered from an excess of Christina Ricci as the surly teen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But
she's like 32.
I know. But her character was 20-ish and a rabble-rouser. Yeah.
I think the word you're looking for is suck.
It kind of did suck, unfortunately. And again, several characters that I liked and a couple of actors that I liked, including, as I have said before, the delightful Vianne Cox as the school marmish stewardess boss lady.
Yeah.
You know, I was hoping that was going to be a little recurring part for her because she's always delightful to watch, but not so much.
Yeah. Well, we should mention that Tanya Ballard-Brown was on one of our early shows and very diplomatically split her vote, refused to pick one.
Right.
Split her vote between, I believe, Once Upon a Time and Grimm.
Yeah, which is...
And Scandal.
And Scandal.
I think.
Yeah, and Scandal and all the other shows.
And here's the thing. Tanya, 3 for 3.
Yep.
Those shows are all coming back. Mm-hmm. All coming back. So 3 for 3, I think, is an outstanding record. Stephen Thompson.
Sure. You just wanted to dampen my massive success. Because here, literally, this was going to be all of my commentary on having picked Revenge.
Smooth.
So you picked Revenge, did you,
I
Steven?
Picked Revenge.
You picked it for its name, Stephen.
You
doesn't
it.
Count.
You picked it so that you could shake your fist at the heavens.
I was going to say, how much of it have you watched?
Right.
You know, I like the fact that Trey stuck with Pan Am and Glenn stuck with Terra Nova. Did you actually watch A Gifted Man?
Oh, no. I watched the pilot. That was
I watched the first one or two episodes of Revenge, thought, this is great, I'll totally watch this again, and then totally never,
never did. No, I have watched every single episode of that show.
So Trey, tell us about Revenge, except in addition to the fact that I picked it and
I think the point is, you know, very soapy show, lots of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, opinions vary as to whether it's lost its way a little bit in the late episodes, as I think is very common, but it is coming back for next year. It is one of a bunch of shows that were renewed.
The basis on which I picked it, which was not just my desire to yell, Revenge!
But mostly.
Which, it was a fact. But was the idea that Desperate Housewives was this creaky, hapless engine of...
Just recently over.
And this felt very much like a similarly enjoyably soapy, hammy, fun show that people would that people would connect with.
And as we talked about at the time, when the show started out, I thought it wasn't hammy. I thought it wasn't soapy. I thought it had an internal tension because the main character, Emily Van Camp, didn't permit herself to chew the scenery. It was serving revenge very cold. And I thought that was intriguing, and it really lost that internal tension very soon. And now it's just a soap where I just imagine people to throw each other into ponds.
And before we get too hard on ourselves about those of us who picked things that failed, I thought I would read a quick list of what's been canceled between you know, the time we had this conversation and now, just on the broadcast networks. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you expand out to cable, the list is much, much unmanageably longer. Here's the list of what's been canceled. A Gifted Man, Alcatraz, Alan Gregory, Are You There, Chelsea, Awake, Bent, BFF, Breaking In, Charlie's Angels, The Finder, The Firm, Free Agents, GCB, Hater, How to Be a Gentleman, I Hate My Teenage Daughter, Man Up, Missing, Pan Am, Playboy Club, Prime Suspect, Ringer, The River, Rob, Secret Circle, Terra Nova, Unforgettable, and Work it.
Work it.
So the great thing is there are some truly execrable shows on that list, which the American public, you know, happily, warmly, rightly rejected. Yep. Rob, Work It, Man Up. Some of these are absolutely appalling. On the other hand, I will say, I believe one of the things I pointed out when we had this conversation last time was just how few shows had survived from the previous year.
Yeah.
And I believe there were three networks between whom one show had been renewed. I can't remember if it was NBC, ABC, and Fox, or NBC, ABC, and CBS. But at any rate, surviving shows just from last season, Two Broke Girls, Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23.
Really?
Grimm, Heart of Dixie, Last Man Standing, New Girl, Once Upon a Time, Person of Interest, Revenge, Scandal, Smash, Suburgatory, Touch, Up All Night, Whitney, and X Factor.
That's actually a fairly surprisingly robust...
It's a long list.
It's a decent
now,
lineup.
There are some appalling shows on there as well, including Whitney, which should die.
Hey, now, I got a friend who works on that
Whitney,
show.
I said Whitney, which should die, not who should die. I'm just saying.
She didn't say everyone involved should die.
So it actually was a season that's at least hanging around a little bit longer
than last year. And I have to say, can I just register my sadness about the demise of GCB?
I was going to say, you're a fan of GCB.
I was kind of a fan of GCB.
I know Tanya is, too. I heard you speaking to Miss Tanya today.
I mean, as you may have noticed, I like to watch trashy TV sometimes, but really Annie Potts was doing some fairly solid work there.
And I have heard nice things.
Mostly because the lineup of slow-talking man candy on that show was just unparalleled.
Yeah. Well, aside from Last Man Standing, which is the Tim Allen version.
Oh, that made the cut.
Horror fest.
Yeah. Most of the masculinity crisis has gone the way of the dodo bird.
Well, that's good.
As it were, How to Be a Gentleman and Man Up and some of that junk. And, of course, Work It. Uh-huh. Speaking of junk.
Work It, which got canceled like 9 months ago.
Yeah, I think Work It got canceled before it even aired, practically.
Should note a few of the kind of venerable shows that lasted 8, 9, 10 seasons that also came to an end. Kind of one on each network, I thought. CSI Miami,
right.
Desperate Housewives, Chuck, House, and One Tree Hill.
Yeah, definitely some long-running shows coming to an end, some of which were highly regarded at least at one time, like House, some of which were never regarded highly at all, like One Tree Hill, which was
a very important show in a way to some people.
Well, I'll tell you what was important about One Tree Hill. One Tree Hill was the show that, more than any other show, brought everyone together in a spirit of, is that still on? And that is
like
something...
Like Seventh Heaven did for a while.
Exactly. Is that still on? Is One Tree Hill still... And it was. It was right up until the very, very bitter end. And, of course, there are some things that started up last season that got a lot of publicity. Ringer with Buffy did not go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, didn't last. I think that one got devoured by Revenge, which was similarly bitchy and a show people liked a lot more. You know, certainly not unhappy about the demise of Hater.
After four, I think three episodes aired, or maybe four.
Yeah. Unfortunately, as we tape this, most of the upfronts haven't happened yet. I've seen some of the clips from NBC, but most of them aren't out yet, so I haven't made my full bunch of calls for the new fall season. But I'm sure there will be some things that are worth watching.
And I have a feeling that when we do our sort of fantasy TV game again, where we pick one of the new shows, my guess is that I will be right again.
Uh-huh.
Well, you would predict that. you would predict that.
Among other things of note, Cougar Town is moving from ABC to TBS.
It is, which is another really interesting development. If you take, for example, your Cougar Town and your Community, right?
Mm-hmm.
People who love them really, really love them, but they've never managed to create a large audience. And for Cougar Town, that's particularly a problem because it spent a fair amount of time with other ABC comedies that were much more beloved. And so, you know, ABC is much more likely to really be looking for shows to put on that night with Modern Family and stuff like that are really going to be strong. So I think there was a little more pressure on that show. But it is going to TBS, which... Yeah, TBS is starting to have a little bit of a pedigree in decent comedy.
That's certainly how they're branding themselves.
That's certainly how they're branding themselves. They did make a show, for example, called My Boys that a lot of people liked. They're kind of getting into the original comedy beyond Tyler Perry, where they've had a lot of luck with a lot of Tyler Perry stuff. But besides that, you know, they are making a bigger play. And that's kind of what they were doing when they got Conan as well. So
it makes a lot of sense. I mean... One thing I would love to see with that is if they could stop calling it Cougar Town.
Well, you know, they've kind of done that joke so much now that I think at this point, you know.
I would love it if they stopped talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. That's sort of one way to go, is to just go ahead and jump to cable, and the expectations are a little different, and
right.
the opportunity to serve a small but devoted audience is a little different. NBC took Community and did sort of the equivalent of putting you on cable, which is to put you on
put
Friday.
It on Friday.
And it's interesting because it made a lot of Community fans really, really unhappy, which I understand. But at the same time, that show's been on for 3 seasons. It has a very specific demographic. It has a very specific audience. I think the people who love it really love it. If I'm NBC, what I'm thinking is, it's a great thing to have in your portfolio because you just don't have that many really highly regarded shows.
Right.
And you don't have that many shows that people really, really love. So it's great to keep it around, but at the same time, it's a very small audience.
Chuck it in a low risk.
Why not take it to
where
a place
people will DVR it?
Exactly.
Anyway.
I think consigning right. something to Friday night is different today than it was
yes.
even 3 years ago, 2 years ago.
Well, to me, it's the closest thing you're going to get to a network saying, we almost don't care who watches it when it's on.
Mm-hmm.
We just want to continue having it be one of our shows.
Yeah.
Like, we don't really care about the size of the live audience. Because it's almost like at some point there are going to be people making stuff, like Netflix is planning on making stuff and things like that, where there is no broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like NBC taking that show and being like, this is going to be almost like the show made by Netflix. You're going to find it and get it however you want. You're probably hardly at all going to watch it when it's on, but you're going to love it, and it's going to bring us a certain amount of goodwill, and it's going to avoid a huge avalanche of not goodwill. And that way, you know, they've got room on Thursday to continue to try to grow the stuff on Thursday that they think.
Speaking of goodwill and not goodwill, we've touched once or twice on the name of Smash. Are any of you still hate watching it?
Nope.
I have hate watched it off and on.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight, as we tape this, is the mm-hmm. season finale, so I do plan on hate watching the season.
So the assumption is, I mean, seriously, hate watching.
It's
like this
it
is
has
so
gotten
terrible.
So terrible. It has gotten so bad.
And that's being brought back as a mid-season replacement.
Yes.
It's coming back in what, January?
Next season, it'll be mid-season. Yeah.
And they have booted the showrunner, and they're bringing in a new showrunner, the guy from Gossip Girls.
So you can sort of tell where they're going. And the interesting thing about the hate watching of Smash, when I first saw Smash, I thought of it exactly what people think of it now.
Yes, as do
which
I.
is, A, it's really corny. B, they don't understand who's who on their own show.
Right.
They think this one is the sweet
right,
heroine.
Right.
And this is, in fact, the one I want to get punched in the face
exactly.
a lot. Whereas this one over here you're trying to set up as kind of the operator and the bad girl. And that's
right.
clearly the one I'm going to root for the entire time. Now,
yep.
I haven't continued to watch everything. But a lot of the stuff that people talk about now, the people are simpy and sort of, you know, the hating the Deborah Messing character. These are all things I thought were right there in the pilot. Mm, so yeah. to me, it's like vindication. It's the same thing that happened with Two Broke Girls, which started off with terrific, terrific reviews in the fall. And gradually, other people have gotten just as tired of it as I was after I had watched it for about 10 minutes.
So, bottom line, you and Stephen Thompson, excellently right.
I know. I'm wrong about so many things. But it just so happens that Smash and Two... It just so happens that Smash and Two Broke Girls are two where people have really come around to my point of view.
Yeah.
And I will say, many people really, really like New Girl a lot more than they did. But there are also other people who have come to understand why I reacted violently and angrily
mm-hmm.
to it.
Yep.
Stephen, for your sake, I hope there's a show next season called something like Curse You, so your streak will stay.
Damn you!
Exactly.
There's a show called Damn You.
Damn You, McGillicuddy.
I did.
Damn You, McGillicuddy.
Damn You, McGillicuddy. I did see that The Celebrity Apprentice will return at mid-season next year, but it will only be 1 hour.
Really?
Wow.
No more two-hour episodes.
So there won't be anything on except Boardroom now. It'll just be an hour of them sitting in the boardroom fighting.
Pine Sol is a great company.
Yeah.
Oh, I already can't wait.
Did you miss the one with the touchscreen hairdryer?
No, I saw it.
This company introduced the greatest touchscreen hairdryer of all time.
I mean, seriously,
it was one of those things where you're like, that's not even a thing. Who's ever heard of a touchscreen? And of course, no, everyone is afraid of saying the thing you should say, which is, seeing Donald Trump talk about a touchscreen hairdryer is hilarious. Like, maybe that'll help him out a little bit with the blow drying. But nobody wants to say it because he has too much money. So, yeah, I mean, you know, most of the things that I really, really love that anybody wanted to come back are coming back.
Mm-hmm.
I do recommend that Warren Littlefield book. It's a very interesting, called Top of the Rock. If you happen to be on Twitter, there's a guy on Twitter by the name of Masked Scheduler who works for Fox, whose actual name is Preston Beckman, who's an executive at Fox, scheduling, kind of high-up scheduling guy. I think he's a high-up programming guy now, but was a scheduling guy at NBC, plays a large role in this book, and it was very, very enjoyable to see him kind of as a big character in this book because I know him through Twitter a little bit. So strongly recommend Top of the Rock.
One last question about television, Linda. What is the name of the Betty White prank show about
old
people?
It's funny you should ask. It's called Betty White's Off Their Rockers.
Off Their Rockers. Did that get renewed?
Gosh, you know, I haven't seen it on any of the lists, so I have no idea whether they really kind of intended for it to get renewed or whether it was really intended as kind of a one-off run of episodes. But it's funny you should mention that because, as Stephen Thompson mentions, Betty White's Off Their Rockers, TM.
As one does.
Yeah. As I said, television seems to have some issues sometimes with the way it presents, in particular, older people, and we got talking about that this week in the context of all things Betty White's Off Their Rockers.
Yeah.
Now, if you have not seen Betty White's Off Their Rockers, here's the general setup. Very, very short clips, sometimes 15 seconds, of some older person playing some prank on some younger person. So, for example, younger person walking down the street, all of a sudden, doors of the ambulance fly open and an old man in a hospital gown jumps out with an IV pole and runs down the street. Ah! Jumping out of there. And the younger person looks around like, what?
What?
There's one that's been in all the ads where a guy pulls out his own tooth.
Hmm. Oh.
Right in front of someone.
Awkward.
Oh, I'm just going to pull this out. Mm, don't do it, man. Don't do it. Pull it out. It's not dignified.
So it's like candid camera, but with old people?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And not nearly the setup of a kind of rich, candid camera.
So it doesn't live up to the lofty standards set by candid camera.
Well, candid camera always had a certain amount of setup, as
right.
I say. Mm-hmm. You know, this is more just extremely unconvincing. Like, you would never believe any of this was real. You know, unlike a good prank. This like makes punked look subtle.
The commercials seem to sort of have a certain amount of
yes,
kind of to it.
And
is that in the show as well? That kind of America's Funniest Home Videos, like, yeah. Auga.
You know, I think so. And I should direct you to a piece that Tara Ariano wrote about this show and how horrifying it is. But the thing about this show is essentially the joke is anything old people do is hilarious. Especially if somehow it plays on the idea that they're crazy, forgetful, unpredictable, unstable.
Okay, so it's not playing off the rapping granny meme.
Oh, it sort of
so
is, yeah.
It's the humor doesn't lie in an old person doing something. You wouldn't associate an old person doing
it. I'm sure some of it does, yeah.
Okay.
But it's all at the expense of the older person to me.
And when that happens in a live-action show, when a Cloris Leachman is doddering, for
that's
example.
That's a tough example.
It's a tough example. However,
and this is on Raising Hope.
When it happens on Raising Hope. When it happens on The Simpsons with Abe Simpson, it's hilarious. I don't know what it is. It takes the tragedy out of it. Because what does Abe Simpson do? He speaks the grim truth. I'm cold and frightened, he says. Or
old man yells at cloud.
Or old man yells at cloud, exactly. So, yeah, I don't know why that gets to me. That works. And poor Cloris Leachman doing something and having Depends jokes made.
So you're not into that on Raising Hope?
Nope.
A lot of humor that is borderline in one way or another. The easiest way to be forgiven for envelope-pushing humor is to be funny.
Right.
Right.
And I think a lot of the Abe Simpson stuff, and if you're going to go down that road on The Simpsons, I mean, Mr. Burns.
Yeah. Sure.
You're looking at Futurama, Hubert Farnsworth. Mm. There's certainly lots of these, like, really, really withered old people who very often, are sort of wetting themselves. But it's in the context of jokes.
Yeah. The three people you've mentioned tend to have really outdated references, don't know what's going on, as opposed to the poop and the urine jokes.
When there are, they're vague, they're passing. Mm. They're not the basis of any of those characters.
Where do we come down on old people and sex equals funny?
I'm not crazy about it.
Well, that's you guys all talk about the Golden Girls then, because I'll check myself out.
Well, there's the Golden Girls, but there's also Betty White on Saturday Night Live doing her Dusty Muffin speech.
Right, yeah. I think Betty White has sort of brought a lot of this to the forefront, because if you watch Betty White when she was on, not just the Golden Girls, which I think she was very funny on, but also when she was on Mary Tyler Moore, mm-hmm. Really funny and really sort of clever and kind of winking and in this really aware kind of way. And now so much of what they have her do is so broad and so silly. It has kind of lost this entire... She used to have this sort of, like I say, knowing wink. I would say even as late as when she was doing the publicity around the proposal and stuff like that, which was only a few years ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, also keep in mind, first of all, that Betty White now is sort of shorthand for people are going to think this is awesome.
Right.
But also that Betty White then, around that time, also had the public persona, a very earned public persona of being a whip-smart kind of awesome lady. Oh, you saw her on winning $25,000 pyramid right and left because she was so damn smart.
Queen of password. No one better.
Oh, and also the funniest person on Match Game.
Absolutely.
Much of the time.
I was kind of thinking about what are the categories of the way older people are characterized on comedy, but even in drama. And it sort of breaks down to senile, evil, potty-mouthed.
Mm-hmm. You forgot cuddly.
Like where?
Yeah, I guess every once in a while your lovable grandmother's home is going to be raised and so you need to throw a bikini car wash or whatever.
Yeah, right.
But,
yeah.
You know, I think that's fairly secondary, though, to Mr. Burns, Mr. Potter.
I think on shows, for example, if we're going to talk about TV, on shows that are good generally, they're likely to be better with this. Mm-hmm. I would call up Matt Saracen's grandma on Friday Night Lights.
Great.
On the one hand, she has a lot of the problems associated with aging. She has issues of dementia as the show progresses, and they're problematic, and they create embarrassing problems for her family, and there's a lot of very serious stuff about how she's going to be cared for and all that stuff.
But a lot of that stuff is about preserving her, and I've only seen the first part of the show, but it's already, even in the first few episodes, about a desire to preserve her dignity.
And she is also still allowed to have a personality and to sometimes be funny and be fun and be wise and things like that. So they haven't kind of gone over into, you know, this is Matt's old grandma. She never knows what's going on. It's much more what I think people experience in real life, which is there's a certain amount of in and out. There's kind of the good days and bad days stuff going on. Mm-hmm. So I think when you get a better show, you're going to get better portrayals.
And I've always thought that horror was just about fear of death. But if you think about it, there's certain genres which are really about fear of losing it, fear of senescence. Like, vampires are about wanting to stay young. Because what happens when you kill a vampire, they turn into a very old, wrinkled-looking thing. Mm-hmm. Zombies which just sort of shamble around with their arms outstretched. What is that but the 5 p.m. dinner rush at Applebee's? Same thing.
Did not think you were going there. I thought you were going somewhere else.
I think what you're saying is that you feel that that is the fear of losing your faculties.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Senescence.
Exactly. I mean, the thing about zombies is you can use them as a metaphor
of being alive but only in body.
Exactly.
Right.
That's
and
what
I think
it's grappling with.
And I think that is a real fear that a lot of people have about aging.
Absolutely.
It's much more of a fear.
It's why I intend to go down in a hail of gunfire.
And I think that's become more of a fear as we get older, but kind of hang around longer and things.
Absolutely.
So it wouldn't wouldn't be a thing that kind of
not everybody wants to live to be 105.
Exactly.
Depending on who you've seen who's lived to be 105.
Right.
In Bram Stoker's Dracula, he starts out as an old dude, and as he drinks more blood, he gets younger. So it's there in the idea of the vampire
and
from the
always,
very beginning.
There's also always a tremendous amount of that in fairy tales. There are elements of that in Snow White, elements of that in Rapunzel, which I at least in the way it's told in Tangled, which I haven't just seen yesterday.
Right.
So I think it's also always been an element, particularly for women, but for everyone. It's always been an element, too, of fairy tales, fear of growing old, wanting to stay young forever, obviously, depictions of the Fountain of Youth
exactly.
and all that stuff. But one of the things we talked about was the treatment in some ways of older people becomes almost similar to the way they treat little kids, meaning you're there to spout a line that because you are old/young, the line is supposed to be funny, where it wouldn't be funny, you know, you got it, dude. Like, that's not funny unless you happen to be a 3-year-old girl. And then everyone thinks it's funny, you know, when you say that.
Daw.
Exactly. Exactly. And they do the same thing with older people in certain movies and shows, I would argue. A certain line is only funny if it's an old lady saying it.
There are parallels in drama, too. I mean, just happened to have rewatched The Sixth Sense, and there are things that happen because that kid is so contained. There are moods that are struck because that kid is so contained and speaks with such authority in some places.
Yeah.
An effect that you couldn't create if you had a teenager doing that or an adult.
I think that's a good example of kind of a good use of youth.
And the reason that there were so many adorable Muppets in sitcoms of the 70s and 80s, Different Strokes, Small Wonder, all those horrible shows, is because they were kid shows. They needed to give kids somebody to identify with. I mean, yes, the audience would go, aw, when he said something adorable, or she said something adorable, or terrible, as the case often was. But it was about getting kids to identify, which is kind of what the whole idea of the comic book superhero sidekicks about. When Batman got Robin, that was because they wanted to give kids who are reading the book somebody to identify with. Mm-hmm. And DC did it in sort of an abstract way, which is like, you want to be there with Batman. He's your big brother. You're hanging out together. But Fawcett Comics made it less abstract. They said, let's have a 10-year-old kid be the superhero. This is about wish fulfillment, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So instead of having them wish to be with Batman or Green Arrow or whomever, let's have this kid say a magic word to turn him into a superhero. I mean, that's literal wish fulfillment. And for the end of the 40s and the beginning of the 50s, Captain Marvel, Shazam, outsold Superman, outsold everybody else by thousands, in some cases a million, because it tapped into that identification thing a lot more directly.
What's the cartoon with the two kids and they go and they... Dragon Tales. Mm-hmm. And they go in their room and then they travel and they sort of can leave their house and go into sort of fantasy land. And they're not superheroes exactly, but they're able to sort of tunnel into this alternate universe. And because my nephews used to watch Dragon Tales, that's what comes to mind for me, because I used to watch a lot of Dragon Tales. Yeah. I'm telling you.
It's already in my head.
It's all in there, buddy.
That theme song. But I think Glenn makes a really, really good point about so much of the presentations of children in popular culture are about the empowerment of those kids. And you look at a lot of very, very, very successful movies of somewhat recent vintage, from your Spy Kids back to your Home Alone, you know, of here is a kid, and you take the resentments that kids often have and you give them opportunities to sort of burst out of them and take control over their surroundings and prove how awesome they are when separated from their parents.
Mm-hmm. Do we still have that in live action movies, or has that essentially all been transferred into animated?
That's a really good
question. Because I'm trying to think whether there are any famous kid actors in movies right now, like Macaulay Culkin was at that time.
Right. I think a lot of the most, as we discussed recently, or actually as recently as last week, you know, you have these sort of young stars who tend to be confined to your Nickelodeon and your Disney Channel. And,
sure.
And
so in
whatever,
terms of movies,
like kid
I
stars,
feel like it's kind of gone.
So, what's her name? So there's Chloe Grace Moretz from Kick-Ass. And,
right.
And
Hugo.
There
exactly.
are various Fannings, I suppose.
There's
they might be
Fannings of various sorts.
Fannings of various vintages. Yeah. And some you have kind of upper tier actresses, your Hailee Steinfeld, for example,
right.
who's still only 15.
Of course.
But you know, but somebody who seems to have a very bright future, but is kind of already transitioning into adult work.
But in terms of those kid empowerment comedies,
who is the Culkin of the moment?
I do feel like a lot of that ground has been ceded to a combination of the Disney Channel and animated movies.
Because
obviously you do have it on Disney still.
CGI adventures as well. What was the Gerbils movie? Not Gerbils.
Oh, G-Force?
G-Force.
Yeah. Wow, thanks, Thompson.
I've seen it.
Yeah.
The other thing about empowerment, I mean, we talked about this a little bit before, but the way kids learn things in adventure novels or mystery novels is by eavesdropping, because they don't have any agency.
Right.
So
right.
This happened all the time in The Golden Compass, happened all the freaking time in Harry Potter. One of the things that The Hunger Games gets right is it doesn't have a lot of information being imparted to the to the main character because she's hiding in a closet.
Yeah, and I actually wonder, in the wake of The Hunger Games, I actually wonder whether those empowerment stories like Home Alone was and like Spy Kids was and stuff like that are more likely to be told as darker stories of sort of a much more genuine and
Well,
and
Home Alone,
darker.
I mean, if you go back and rewatch that, there's some dark
bloodlust
in that.
Incredibly violent.
But it's not played that way.
And the kid is not particularly imperiled.
Well, and remember, you know, not only was there Home Alone, but then, you know, he went on and did My Girl movies and, you know, I mean, even some of the stuff we've talked about to cross over a little bit with our teen discussion, the Stand By Me and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to say, because I'm trying to figure out if there are like 12-year-old movie stars right now, and I'm not sure there are.
Well, and here's a question is how often do child actors give voice to the way kids actually talk? Because I've noticed a lot in for example, we recently watched Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close when we were talking about the Oscars, and you have this kid who admittedly is an odd kid, and he's not.
The implication is that he's autistic.
Right. He speaks in this, and even Hailee Steinfeld in True Grit.
Very stylized.
Speak in these very, very stylized ways that don't feel naturalistic. Yeah, and how many child actors are delivering naturalistic dialogue.
And frankly, that's true of older people as well.
That's true.
I mean, honestly.
To go back to the kid on Once Upon a Time, at the center of that show is this really contrived idea that this woman who comes to town, who is actually the kid's mom, has to find a way to hang out with him, even though the mayor of the town absolutely forbids that. And so there's all this plot machinations of just trying to get these two people together. Mm-hmm. And the kid is sort of like this passive character who's always right. He's the Wesley Crusher. He's the he's the kid that you just can't stand.
And I will say the portrayal by a young actor that always sticks with me as one of my absolute favorites in movies was in the only so-so Meg Ryan movie, When a Man Loves a Woman, where she was an alcoholic. Tina Majorino was in that movie, she still acts, and she's a very good actress. But she was a wee thing in that movie. She and Mae Whitman was the other little girl. And they are both, but especially Tina Majorino, will just break your heart clean in half. And it's so sad. So if you're thinking about, like, can a kid ever be great in a movie, go back to that one.
There you go.
So anyway, if you have thoughts about old people and young people and are you pro or con the elderly, come find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or find us at the blog at npr.org/monkeysee. What is your favorite performance by an older person? What is your favorite performance by a younger person? We are curious. And that brings us to our final segment of the show. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
On Saturday night, my partner of 14 years surprised me with a trip to the Latin Ballet. And I can say that I was legitimately surprised. I did not see that coming. If I had guessed for days, I wouldn't have gotten to Latin Ballet.
I bet you were.
I've always found ballet kind of airless and snooty, and I think it's because I learned this on Saturday night. It's because of the music.
I swear I thought you were about to say I learned this on Saturday Night Live. I'm like, that is not a good way to guess.
Right. I don't feel an in to classical music. I didn't grow up with it, so I just can't. It always feels like homework to me, and whenever we listen to it at home, I always feel like the biggest poser in the world. Here's the thing about Latin music. It's all in. There is no out to Latin music.
Right.
It's got a rhythm, and it's going to get you. And even me, who is arrhythmic, was born without rhythm. If I circumnavigated the planet Arrakis on foot, no worm sign. Absolutely none. No rhythm.
Come on.
This was great. Now, the dudes were hot, didn't hurt, and the music was fantastic. And in the middle of it, rising up out of the orchestra pit, was the Colombian singer Toto La Mampusina, who was amazing. And she was singing La Vida Es Un Carnaval, my favorite Celia Cruz song. And I'm not going to go crazy here. I clapped in rhythm. I mean, that's about that's about as good as a Welshman can do.
Upbeat or downbeat?
I don't know what you mean. I don't know what you just said. But here's the thing people don't tell you about the ballet. Squeaky. It's squeakier than you expect because of the shoes on the floor. I didn't realize
that. The floor.
Yep. It was amazing.
Like
it was wonderful.
Watching high school basketball.
It was great. I would recommend, if you're thinking, ballet, try some Latin ballet. It's awesome.
That is amazing.
Would not have expected.
I know, right?
Latin ballet.
I know.
Rock and roll. And I just want to say,
we had some
go.
Drinks before.
I just want to also say, way to go, partner of 14 years.
There you go.
You. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, in her continuing campaign for weekly mention on the show, superfan Margaret H. Willison linked to us on our Facebook page to the story of how a 5-year-old Captain America nerd ended up sitting on Tom Hiddleston's shoulders on the set of The Avengers.
This is what's going to make
and
you
became
happy
a gigantic
say,
internet
this was
star.
What made you happy last
no,
week.
This was that was Mark Ruffalo's kid.
Each week on
Each
Pop
week,
Culture Happy Hour,
there will be a Tom Hiddleston.
Tom Hiddleston and a Muppet.
This is because, despite my better judgment, I read this story of how the 5-year-old Captain America nerd ended up sitting on his shoulders, and the result is that I now could not love Tom Hiddleston anymore if his married name were Cumberbatch.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So.
That is hardcore.
That is what's
Graham.
Making me happy.
Again. I was going to say, I'm almost positive I heard this when I was driving home from vacation. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Filling my Wisconsin-sourced news feed all last week. Because I like to get, it's sort of like letters from home to find out how things are going in my beloved home state of Wisconsin, were stories about the state legislature proclaiming December 12th, 2012, let's make 12-12-12 Aaron Rodgers Day.
Oh.
It is spawned from a Facebook campaign started by one of my oldest dear friends from when I was a kid in Wisconsin named Jennifer Berlowski. And she just started like a little Facebook group called Let's Make 12-12-12 Aaron Rodgers Day. And then it actually happened and there was a ceremony in the state legislature and all these photos filling my newsfeed are of Aaron Rodgers in a suit standing at a podium next to my dear friend Jennifer Berlowski. And it was incredibly delightful and heartening, and more to the point, it was a stirring reminder that people like you and me, we can start our own holidays. Yeah. And we are less than 2 months away from Appreciation Day 2.
No. I don't have anything to wear.
Glenn Weldon's favorite celebration of sentiment, as heavily discussed and soon to be again heavily discussed on this very podcast.
That is wonderful. So now you have to go and like rub up against her and try to get some atoms. You have to like run out there before she takes a shower and be like,
yeah. I don't know if she's bathed since, but December 12th.
I know you haven't. If it was this week.
Well, I know, regardless, that on December 12th, 2012, I will wear my Aaron Rodgers jersey to
work. That's wonderful. Congratulations and congratulations to your friend and to Aaron Rodgers and to all the cheeseheads back at home. Well, as you all know, I was on vacation this week. On vacation where there is not so much the TV. You know, aside from catching up with a couple of episodes of Mad Men, which I did download, aside from that, I was very much in the quiet. But I will say, definitely my best activity was making pottery. I made pots. I made pots on the wheel.
This is sounding perilously like Saturday Night Live.
It was awesome,
Linda. None of us smoke, so no ashtrays. Yeah.
There's no ashtrays. They're lovely, and it was with Elise. At a place that I am going to pronounce Pinku Pottery. It's P-I-N-C-U. But it is in Bryson City, North Carolina. And she is a lovely, lovely person. She was incredibly patient, gave me a two-hour lesson, helped me patch the bottom of the coffee mug that had holes in it. And it was just...
kind of a minor design flaw.
The entire thing was just absolutely super. It was incredibly fun. So thank you, Elise. That's A.
Well, I didn't get a whole week, but I did get 2 days in Amish country on two gorgeous days.
Did you make pottery?
And no pottery, huh?
Shut up. Anyway.
Yeah, then forget you.
So that's A. B is my friends on Twitter. I tweeted a request for recommendations for books to read on vacation and basically took my entire vacation reading list from the recommendations I got on Twitter. And so I wanted to thank everybody who gave me recommendations of books to read. Obviously, I was not able to read everything, but I did read a bunch of the stuff people recommended. And I want to highlight two things. One is a series of novels called Big Stone Gap by a writer named Adriana Trigiani. And that's T-R-I-G-I-A-N-I. And they start with just a novel called Big Stone Gap. And then there are three more. And I read all four of them this week. And so they were great fun. It's sort of a story of over a long history, like 20, 25 years of the lifetime of this woman who lives in a mountain town. Enjoyed them very much. They were recommended on Twitter. Appreciate that. But the big delightful discovery was a book called Let's Pretend This Never Happened, a mostly true memoir by Jenny Lawson, who blogs as The Blog-ess.
The Blog-ess, yeah.
And that book is so funny that it truly was one of those things where I got giggling. If you've ever seen me do the thing where I start laughing and then and everyone in this room has seen it, and then I cannot stop laughing and it actually becomes uncomfortable for me and for everyone else.
I think especially for us.
I did that in the motel room that I was staying in.
Oh, awesome.
While reading this book, because I'm peacefully going along reading this book and all of a sudden there's a picture of a raccoon wearing jams. You know how I am with animals wearing people clothes. And all of a sudden there's this raccoon wearing jams. Seriously, jams. If the only thing you got out of this book was to look at a picture of a raccoon wearing jams, it would be well worth it. But that is not at all the funniest part of it. I had several experiences reading this book where I would be reading it and I would have to stop reading reading it, because if you're in a place where people are going to think you're nuts, like if you're sitting in a very, very quiet coffee shop and there's no one there except you and the lady making the coffee, you can't sit there at the table and guffaw. It's not appropriate. So I had to dole it out in small bits. But again, it's called Let's Pretend This Never Happened. It is a mostly true memoir, and it is absolutely delightful and hilariously funny.
I actually had a wonderful, awkward moment of finding a galley of that particular book.
I know exactly where you're going.
In the seventh floor sort of unisex restroom. It's basically my panic room because you can lock it. And people will occasionally leave books and galleys and stuff there. And I saw it, and I saw that you had just recommended it on Twitter and was like, I like this blogger. This mm-hmm. sounds like a great book. How do you smuggle a book out of a restroom without people assuming that you brought that book into the restroom?
That's a good question.
Wow. Well,
if you have an answer to that question, good friends.
Wow.
Find Stephen on...
Email it to stevensshame@gmail.com.
Yeah, don't do that. That's not a real thing, and I bet it's someone's email.
Say, that is not an address of mine.
All right, so those books, Big Stone Gap and also Let's Pretend This Never Happened. And I also, by the way, have never mentioned another book that I got talking to people about this week that I keep meaning to recommend if I haven't already. It's called Attachments. It's by Rainbow Rowell, who is a newspaper columnist, and she's terrific and awesome and funny, and she's got a new book out, and I'm very angry at her because it's only available in the UK so far, and I'm very, very angry.
Rainbow.
I've been scolding her on Twitter about the fact that I can't get it yet. She's possibly threatening to sell me one out of the back of her car. Anyway, so those books, Big Stone Gap, Let's Pretend This Never Happened, and Attachments by Rainbow Rowell. Those are going to be my big takeaways, and those books, believe it or not, are all making me happy this week. That's what happens when I go on vacation.
Books.
That's what happens when I get away from television.
Sheesh.
Anyway, that brings us to the end of our show, and you can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey Graham at Trey Graham. Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. Our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, you can follow at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our happy in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Welcome back.
It's wonderful to see all of you again, and thanks to all of you for listening, and I will see you back here next week.